Hello everyone, welcome along. It's good to have your company today on Planet FM. I'm Alice Worsley with a very special guest for you. His name is Anthony Horowitz and he's written lots of fantastic children's books, but he's also a writer extraordinaire in other areas, as we're going to discover as the interview goes on. But in front of me I have an array of books called Gruesome Grange, The Falcon's Malteser, Eagle Strike, where Alex Rider has 90 minutes to save the world, Point Blank, Skeleton Key, and Stormbreaker, just some of the books that Anthony has written over the years. I've got to say, to start with, you are a very busy, successful writer. Did you ever imagine that your life could become so hectic?
Hectic. Oh, God. I never set out to have a hectic life. I love writing. I mean, that's the thing about it. I'm completely and utterly passionate about my work, and I suppose I make my life hectic because I just can't stop.
You can't? Well, I was reading about you, and you've got so many projects on the go, and you're writing for this, you're writing another children's book, you're speaking here, you're doing this, you're doing that. I mean, you are very much a man on the go.
Well, the actual speaking side of it, I do because my publishers asked me to, and because these days, I think it's one of the things that's happened to writers, we've become more sort of media-wise. We have to go out there, we have to perform at libraries, schools, interviews, whatever. Personally, I'm quite happy just sitting quietly in my little room in London writing the books, because that's really where the work is.
Yes, indeed. But let's go back to find out when the writing for children started, because you've always loved writing. I believe that your mum, at the age of six, sort of used to tell you horror stories.
Yeah, she was a very, very... she was a strange and a wonderful woman in many ways, and one of her slight eccentricities was that instead of doing what most mothers do, which is coming in with a book of fairy tales or whatever at night, she would tell me horror stories. The Fly, The Wolfman, Dracula, every Dracula film. And she'd been to see them at the cinema, and she was telling me the stories out of the films. And so my two of my loves in my life are cinema and horror, and I guess that came straight from my mother... Age six.
And at age 13, your mother was also very kind to you because she she bought you a human skull.
Well, it was something I asked for. To this day, I can't really remember.
How did she get it?
She went to a medical student shop off of Tottenham Court Road and said that she was getting it for her son, the doctor. At 13, I was hardly a qualified medical practicer. But I still have it. It sits by my desk even to this day. And I keep it not out of some kind of macabre sense, although probably that was why I wanted it when I was 13. But it does remind me that life is short.
Yes.
You know, keep writing, keep moving, keep thinking up stories, because you don't know how long it's going to be before you end up like that.
Exactly. Now, you're 48 now, is
I
that
am,
right?
I'm 48. Yes.
And you've packed a lot in, but it wasn't until 23, I think, that you got your first... book published. Was that for children?
Yes, it was. Right. I mean, 23 was quite a young age to get started. Yeah. It was the first book I wrote. To this day, it's a mystery to me quite why I decided to go into children's books. I had no particular intention of doing that. I remember that it was a wet afternoon. I was working in advertising very briefly. I was no good at it. It was only there just to earn a few pennies while I was concentrating on the writing. And I just began to write this story. I didn't plan it. I didn't decide to do it. I just started to write it. It was about a boy called Frederick K. Boer. His father was a building constructor, so his company was called Boer Constructors. And so already the terrible jokes and wordplays are present in the work. And I just wrote this book and finished it. And then sold it, and then Disney bought an opportunity on it, although the film never actually was made. But nonetheless, about a month later, I was in Hollywood. And so it all just happened instantly, with no planning. And to this day, I sometimes wonder, what am I doing in the world of children's books? It used to be just a hobby. It used to be something that kept me sane from my television and film work. But since the Alex Rider books in particular, it's sort of taken over.
And you do more of that almost than you do of the other areas?
I do about 50-50, to be honest. But,
yeah.
But yes, it's become much bigger in my life. The other big thing that's changed, though, is that when I began 10, 20 years ago, I was almost embarrassed to say I was a children's author. There was something about being a children's writer that was very mediocre and second rate. Of course, there was Roald Dahl, who was the undisputed king of the market, but after him, there really wasn't anybody. And reading, if you wanted to buy a children's book, I remember, you know, bookshops, you'd go down to the basement, to their darkest corner, or to the top floor, where, you know, brush away the cobwebs, and there is some unfortunate soul who is in charge of the children's book department. Now, bless her, J.K. Rowling has changed everything.
Yes.
And she has, I mean, you know, besides besides making herself enormously wealthy, and good luck to her, she has really paved the way for the rest of us, because now, of course, every book department prides itself on the children's books department, and children's books have become quite, forgive the word, cool again.
Well, when you were growing up, and when I was growing up, I'm just a fraction older than you, there were the books, there were the classics, and some other books as well, but not the selection that children have today. There's just a wonderful variety I for all types of readers.
I think that's something else that's changed, actually, and I think it's a very good point that in the 60s and 70s, actually even in the 80s and I guess the 90s, a lot of the book buying by adults for their kids were the books that they had read as youngsters themselves. So, I mean, Enid Blyton was still huge, and the Jennings books and Biggles and Just William. Now, these are all good books. I'm not knocking them, and they're still in the shops, and I'm glad to see them. My own kids read Willard Price, whom I read as a child, Jungle Adventure, Amazon Adventure, all those adventure stories. But I think that because of J.K., our people, adults in particular, are much more receptive now to the new wave of kids' writers. You know, obviously, there's Philip Pullman out there. There's Jacqueline Wilson for the girls. You know, you've got some wonderful writers, Jennings and Gleitzman, coming out of
Australia,
this part of the world,
yeah,
Australia,
right.
and the Antipodean part of the world. Forgive me lumping the two of you together there.
We get lumped all the time.
I'm sure it happens, but you know what I mean.
That, you yes,
know,
that, and that we've got our own.
What I'm saying
too,
is, of
yeah.
course, you've got lots and lots of new writers who are more present in a way than the old classic school are. And I think that's a very, very good development. Mm.
I think one of the lovely things, too, about writing today for children is that if you've got kids who are reluctant readers, you've got things that you can give them that are going to turn them on to reading, perhaps even more so than when we were growing up, although Enid Blyton, I guess, was the one that turned lots of children on to reading as a starting point. But these days, there's just so much more to get boys in particular excited about reading. Would you agree?
Well, I'm often called the writer for reluctant readers. I mean, you know, my role in England seems to be, you know, if you don't like reading, your children will love my books. And if I could, you know, I have lost count of a number of mothers and teachers and librarians who have come up to me and said exactly that. Although it was absolutely capped by a French mother at a salon who said, I'd heard it so often, well, Mr. Horowitz, you know, my children never read anything until they read your books. Now they've read everything you've ever written, and they've started reading good writers. And that was, I mean, talk about a backhanded compliment.
Yes.
But at the same time, I was quite happy with it, really, because I think the Alex Rider books in particular, they're such easy reads, but they do, and there's nothing didactic in them, there's nothing educational, you know, they're just fun reads, although I hope well-crafted and well-written and not vulgar, not sort of tripey and not negative in any way. Because I take it, you know, I always say about my books that they're not serious books, but I take them very seriously.
Yes, yeah.
But I think if their role is to introduce children to that wonderful world of readers, and if they're going to read me and then move on to the Philip Pullmans of this world, well and good, you know, yeah. You've got to start somewhere.
Exactly.
So I think that's a good role to have.
Now, you talked about you taking your books very seriously, and I was reading about you and research, and this is fantastic. Not only do you get your teenage son involved, but you actually get involved and make sure that the research within your books, you know what it feels like, for example, to sit in a car that's about to be squashed.
Well, only because I got into a car crusher and told them to turn it on. Yes, I mean, the Alex Rider books are enormous fantasies. I mean, you know, you've got, if you, a classic example, at the end of Stormbreaker, Alex Rider jumps out of a plane with a parachute, he smashes through the roof of the Science Museum, and he shoots the Prime Minister. Now, this is not what you would call an ordinary chain of events. This is fantasy with a capital F. But to make kids buy into it, to make it believable, I want the world in which it all takes place to be as real as possible. So, research. First of all, I'll know about the plane. Secondly, I will know the rudiments of parachute jumping. Thirdly, I went to the Science Museum, I climbed onto the roof, and I describe in the book how the Victorian architects have built a plastic and a glass roof to explain why Alex doesn't get splatted when he hits that roof, how it is possible to break through it. So I do this in every single book. If you read in another book, he goes underneath Wimbledon, there's a fight under Wimbledon. I went there to the tennis tournament and went underground to have a look at what was there. Because the more detail that you put into the books and the more reality, the more fantasy you can get away with. That's my view.
Yeah, and the kids love it. Now, tell us about your Alex Rider books, because they are, as you say, the ones that have obviously turned a lot of children on to writing. And I think I read somewhere that they were described as, is it James Bond with Nikes or something? Or
yes, James Bond in Nikes.
In Nikes, that's right.
That's rather a nice comment.
Tell us how Alex Rider came about, and who is he for our audience who don't know much about
him?
Well,
the story is this. Let's start with the story of the books. We have a 14-year-old boy called Alex Rider who is living with his uncle in West London. His parents having died. In my books, generally the parents are absent. They've either died or emigrated, because I'm interested in the independence of children. So Alex is living with his uncle, whom he believes to be a bank manager in a rather boring international bank. And in the very beginning of the book, the uncle dies in what seems to be a car accident. But as Alex investigates, he very quickly discovers that the car is riddled with bullets. But the uncle wasn't a bank manager, he was a spy, a sort of a prototype James Bond, although obviously for legal reasons I couldn't use those names. So Alex now gets involved with the uncle's life, gets sucked into MI6, and becomes a spy, because MI6 realise that there are all sorts of things that a 14-year-old can do that an adult can't. And so he's sent to schools, to kid environments, and has adventures and saves the world in each book. The villains are always larger than life. Damien Crayer, multimillionaire pop singer in Eagle Strike, and General Sarov, a communist general wanting to bring back communism in Skeleton Key. And these become very, very big adventures in the sort of Bond tradition, but always scaled down to a 14-year-old point of view. Where he came from? Well, principally the James Bond films, of course.
Yeah.
When I was growing up, the James Bond films, you know, just as I was into puberty, really. I mean, that was when Ursula Andress was coming out of the sea clad in that white bikini, and that was my
pin-up. You'll never forget, that's
right. Of course not. You know, these films, the original Sean Connery James Bond films, were for me a huge event every Christmas. There wasn't a worldwide release. They were only on in one cinema. And to get in to see it, you had to queue. I queued in the rain. You know, there were no ticket systems. It's funny how old-fashioned it all was, really, when I was young. But it was the big Christmas event to be the first person to see the new Bond films. And the Sean Connery ones were terribly good. I mean, Goldfinger, Dr. No, From Russia With Love, Thunderball, You Only Live Twice, incidentally written, of course, by another children's author, Roald Dahl. Interesting crossover,
of course,
I always think.
Yes, yes.
And I just loved these films. They were everything to me. You know, all my dreams were based on Bond at a very young age. As an adult, I began to feel that the Bond films lost their way. I can't explain quite why. Part of it was the casting. I don't think Roger Moore was very successful as Bond. Pierce Brosnan is okay, but the films have become just a series of set pieces. You know, they're wonderful to look at.
And spectacular effects.
They are spectacular, yeah. But where's the story?
Yes, exactly.
Where's the character? Where's the humanity? Do we worry that Bond is going to get hurt? Do we worry that he might get killed? No, because he just jumps from one superhuman stunt to the next. And so I was very interested in two things. First of all, in bringing the character back to humanity. But secondly, it occurred to me, and again, I use this awful word, cool. If you want to be cool as a secret agent, you cannot be middle-aged. You've got to be about 14 or 15.
Yeah.
And in that single thought, Alex Rider was born.
Ah, and the name, no significance to that, Alex
Rider?
I'll
tell you where the name came from. Alex was the son of a friend of mine. And was at lunch with me when I was thinking up the character. And this boy also did Taekwondo, which is one of these martial arts, and spoke fluent French. So there was a sort of a little bit of Alex in Alex sitting at the table. The name Ryder, names are very important to me in my work. I spend a lot of time thinking of them. When I originally conceived the books, I thought that it might be the son of James Bond. And going back to Ursula Andress coming out of the sea, the character that she played was Honeychild Ryder.
Ah.
And I thought if Bond had married her, or, you know, had an affair with her, Alex might have been the result. And so I chose that name. It's also a good doing word. I always say, yes, when I'm talking to kids, you know, you choose a name that you know, knights ride, cowboys ride. So a rider is by nature, or by definition, a hero.
Action, indeed. And what about the titles of your books as well? Because you said that you take a lot of time over the names of your characters. I would imagine too, with something like the Falcon's Malteser, you take a lot of time thinking about your titles, or does somebody do those for you?
No, nobody does anything.
You do your own
titles?
Oh,
good heavens,
well?
No, yeah. I wouldn't dream of it. Although I ask for help. I mean, I do. My wife and children get fed up with me asking them to give me titles for books. I do find it difficult. The Falcon's Malteser was easy, though, because that was, I've said I love film, and I decided to do a series of books with these two characters, the Diamond Brothers, 25-year-old detective Tim Diamond, who is stupid, and 13-year-old brother Nick, who is very, very smart, solving crimes together. But all the crimes are based on movies. So the Falcon's Malteser is simply the Maltese Falcon,
yeah,
turned upside,
yeah,
down. I then did all the movies of Alfred Hitchcock, whom I admire very much, and I took North by Northwest and wrote a book called South by Southeast. And so my favourite film of all time, The Third Man, I've written a book called The Blurred Man.
Right.
So those titles normally come first, yeah, and then I think of a story that I can pin onto them.
Yeah.
For the Alex Rider books, it's more difficult. I'm looking for very short titles because I want them to fit in big letters on the cover. I want them to be very Bond-like titles. I mean, Stormbreaker is actually perilously close to Moonraker, but actually it changed its name for various reasons along the way. Eagle Strike seems a good title now, but actually that book had so many different titles when I was writing it. It was going to be called Game Slayer. There is a games system in the book, which is called the Game Slayer game system, which is games player without the P.
Uh-huh.
But nobody quite got that, so I didn't go with it. My son, Cassian, wanted me to call it Never Play Dead. That was his title. Rather good, I thought.
Yes.
Very sort of Bondish in its own way. But we didn't that. Then for a long time it was Eagle Eye. If you read the book, you'll find that there is a reason why there's an eagle in it. There's a sort of a secret. An eagle is code for something that we all know about, in fact, but only turns up towards the end. And it was going to be called Eagle Eye. But then Eye is somehow a little... Eagle Eye is good. It's a very Bondish title, but it's a little close to Golden Eye.
Yes.
And Strike has got more power to it. So that's how that came about. Sometimes they take a long time, the titles.
Yes. And I noticed you talking about talking to your son, Cassian. Do you involve your family quite a bit in your books and storylines, or asking them about, do you think this idea will work?
You've already mentioned that I use my children for the stunts.
Yeah.
It is true that my older son, Nicholas, is a wonderful surfer and snowboarder and skateboarder, and I'm always looking at him and looking at his equipment and asking him to help me with the language of it, to get it right. Cassian has also come with me. We went to a bullfight together to write a sequence in Eagle Strike. Horrible experience. I mean, I'm not very pro bullfighting. But nonetheless, we went there together and we worked chases out together. And I do sometimes ask them for their opinion, but normally after I finish the book. I can't write specifically for my own two sons.
No.
When I'm writing for a worldwide audience of quite a lot of, you know, hundreds of thousands, if not millions of children. I can't be particular.
Do they read your books, though?
They do read them. Yeah. They often give me very helpful criticism. I remember Cassian gave me a wonderful piece of advice after he'd finished reading one of the books. He said there was too much description. He said, Dad, you've even described the glass of water. I know what water looks like.
Yeah.
And when I heard those words, I thought, yes, you are right. And I took out about, well, I don't know, a couple of thousand words of just unnecessary description.
Now, you're evidently published in about 20 countries now, which is amazing. So I would imagine, have you been translated into some languages other than English?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, where are you published?
You name it. I'm just about there. I think there's barely any countries now that don't have me. Recently, China bought Alex Rider, which is wonderful. I mean, I'm very excited about that. And Japan have been doing very well with him. And on my way to New Zealand, I stopped off in Thailand, where they were just launching Stormbreaker, the first book in the series. And so I was doing interviews there, and they all seemed quite excited about it. And America, of course. You know, I'm sure I could think of countries where they're not, but by and large, Alex is just about everywhere now. I was going to say, it's a wonderful, and it's a great privilege as well, to be able to write for such a wide audience. I always feel a little bit sorry for, or guilty about, writers who are, shall we say, Thai writers, who are probably excellent writers, but who will never get that opportunity by and large, it's the English language still that rules.
Very much so. So who reads you then? Looking at your books, it's a bigger print than some, so I'm assuming that you're, about 9, 10 upwards?
I never think about age ranges. I think it's dangerous to do that. I write the books very much with a sort of an inner voice that controls what goes into the quantity of violence, the use of language, the absence of sex. These aren't sort of based on a calculated approach to the age of the reader. I have met children as young as 8. Certainly the earlier books like Gruesome Grange, Granny and The Switch are much younger books and are good, but are very different and sort of sillier and funnier than the later ones. But I've met 8-year-olds reading the Alex Rider books up to 14. At 15 they're moving on, as they should be, to sort of, you know, Stephen King or to Andy McNab or whatever it's going to be, which is fine. And the books are also written, I should say, very much for adults. You know, first of all, if you look at the design of the Alex Rider books, they look like adult books for kids.
They do, yes.
That's what they were meant to look like. But I've always believed that smart parents will involve themselves in their children's reading, because it's a wonderful thing to do. You know, if you read with your son for half an hour at bedtime, it's a wonderful bonding experience. I speak obviously here from experience as a father who I've read many, many books to my children and made up stories with them as well. It's a wonderful, quiet way to end the day. But if you're going to do that, you don't want to be sort of bored rigid by sort of dancing bunny rabbits. There's got to be something in these books for adults too. And I think it's almost a test these days of a good kids' book, is that it does have adult appeal in some way. So, for example, looking at The Falcons Maltesers, since it's in front of you, no child alive on this planet will get that title. Unless they're told. But it might give the parents a smile. And there are plenty of jokes and action and references in the books that are the same.
In some of your books, too, you portray the adults in the story as characters that are over-exaggerated, not always the pleasant people in the story. And you were talking about, you were interested in writing about the child as an independent person. Because for you too, growing up, your parents were not necessarily there a lot for you, were they?
Well, they were. I mean, it's not fair. I haven't been fair to my parents talking about them in public, because they were, in their own way, good people.
Yeah.
I mean, they really did mean well. You know, the fact that they sent me to probably the most awful, hideous school in the planet.
It was a boarding school you went to,
boarding
wasn't
school,
it?
Yes, yes, where sort of, you know, with a flogging headmaster and sort of mean, sadistic teachers and all the rest of it, you know, the typical pub prep school education of the 60s. You know, they did it, they were well-meaning about it. And they were there for me in the sense that, you know, how can I complain about having had an extremely expensive education, to have been brought up with servants and wonderful food and expensive holidays. It seems churlish to complain. What they lacked, I think, my father certainly was any emotional connection with me. Mm-hmm. He never, and I always regret this, never gave me any support in my avowed ambition, which I had at age 8, to be a writer. Mm. He tended to sneer at it, and I think that's a sort of a shame, and it's a shame that he died before I ever got published, so he didn't see that actually I could do it and would do it.
Yeah.
But my mother, you know, as I said, she began her life telling me stories, and she ended her life very proud of the fact that I was published and doing so well as a writer. And I miss her. I didn't know my father very much, but I certainly was very close to my mother, and she died when I was 33, I think, and I still miss her to this day.
Yes, you would do. And it lovely for you to be able to have been a success for her to see.
Yes,
how well those
important
stories told at the age of 6 had kicked in.
Yes, absolutely.
And
yes,
made you the success that you are today. And speaking of success, too, because you have the whole other side to you of writing for adults and writing for television. Tell us in the last few minutes that we've got a little bit about the adult side of Anthony Horowitz.
Well, none of my television is for children. I'm well known in England for murder mystery. I love whodunits. I've written a series called Midsummer Murders, which I think has shown here in New Zealand, and another very highly acclaimed series called Foyle's War, a detective series set in the Second World War, which mysteriously New Zealand has yet to buy. It's been an enormous success next door in Australia, but for some reason the islands here have resisted it, which is a shame because it is my best work. It's a wonderful way of looking at murder at a time when so many murders are taking place just across the English Channel in northern France and in Holland and Belgium, and a lone detective on the south coast having still to sort of do the beat and solve crimes at a time of war. And it's, as I said, been a very big success. I don't know. You know, as I said, the children's writing used to save me from television. Now I sound like the television is saving me from children's writing, but it's a wonderful, I'm very fortunate and quite rare to be one of those writers who is as happy in both areas and can do both.
You were described by the Radio Times as a one-man crime wave, which I thought was lovely
too,
wasn't it?
They also called me a serial killer in another edition. Yes, I like that, one-man crime wave. It is true, I have committed an enormous number of murders on screen.
Yeah, and you've got a movie either coming out or just come out with Christina Ricci.
The Gathering will be in New Zealand, I think, this year. I haven't even seen it, goodness knows
what. You wrote
what
the screenplay for
I wrote
it, though,
the screenplay,
you?
But I'm not sure that means very much, because by the time Miramax have finished chopping it to pieces and everything, I don't know what it's going to be like.
It may look nothing like what you started out with.
But at the same time, it was a good, solid screenplay, and it might still be a good film. I hope so.
Indeed. And listen, I've got to ask, finally, because as I read the biographies at the beginning of each book and a little bit about the stories, there is a dog that's mentioned, along with your wife and two children. But I got confused because it went from unlucky, lucky, plucky.
No, his name was Lucky.
Lucky.
And then one day, I reversed the car and ran him over. So I called him Unlucky after that. But then we took him to the vet, and he pulled through fine. And he was so brave that I changed his name again to Plucky. And that's why his name keeps changing.
And what kind of dog is he?
He's a chocolate Labrador.
Oh, how lovely. Well, he's certainly gone through a few names. Have you included him in your book at all?
One of the books is vaguely dedicated to him. How embarrassing. But
I think that's wonderful.
But it's fine. You know, the other thing is I just always think that the blurb and the dedications are part of the book, and you should always slip some little secret in there.
Indeed.
Too.
Indeed. So I always read them, I think you find some wonderful things. Well, your latest book is called Eagle Strike.
Yes.
That's the latest
that's the one now.
Alex
There'll be
Ryder.
Another one next year, Scorpio, number 5 in the series, is just six chapters from the end at the moment.
Wonderful. Well, lots of great books. Skeleton Key, Stormbreaker, Eagle Strike, Point Blank, and then of course the Diamond Brothers story, The Falcon's Malteser. There's Grange, and there's one about a granny too.
There is one called Granny. Yes.
Okay, and it's all by Anthony Horowitz. They're wonderful books, and if you're a mum or a dad, get them for the kids. But don't forget, read them yourself. You'll love them. Thank you so much
for
your time.
Alice.
Thank you.